Krishna's God, Prabhupada is his pure representative. And this is everything. Krishna's everything. I really saw that. And yet I was 20 years old, and I don't think I was one day more mature than my age. I mean, I wasn't like, I was 20, but I had the maturity of a 21-year-old, not even that. Mm-hmm. So I went to, like, for example, I had a physics class. This is Berkeley, you know, the great science centers of the world. So I went to my physics class, and we had a teacher want to know how much we knew. So we took little tests, and one of the questions was, what's the definition of energy? The right answer, which is perfectly acceptable, is the ability to do work. That's energy. But I wrote this paragraph or two about energy is the potency of the Supreme Personality of God or Krishna. Because this was 1969, and I was just sort of dovetailing my revolutionary fervor. Because, you know, it's like, so it just you know, made a little transfer. Okay, the enemy is not, you know, the government and the Pentagon. The enemy is my physics professor. So, so I wrote this whole thing about, you know, the internal and external potency of Krishna and so on, Bhagavad Gita. And the teacher, because, I mean, the students really had power back then, so the teacher didn't want to get on the wrong side of the students. Clearly, they'd end up, you know, something bad would happen. So, so the teacher said, I respect your views. However, this is a physics class, and so, and I remember I was, I don't know the way to describe myself, and I mean, I'm not proud of it, but I was, when I was young, I was a real, like, I don't know you'd call it, theological gunslinger. In the sense of, you know, debate and all that. It's like the kind of guys that go to bars because that's where fights break out. So for me, it was not like a physical fighting level, but, you know, debate and all that. And so, I remember we stood outside. He was a nice guy, actually, poor guy. We stood outside the classroom about half an hour after the class, and, you know, going out trying to convince him, you know, no, this is this. And he couldn't really move me, and so it just ended with, I respect your views, but that's not the right answer. So, and then I went to my French class. Hare Krishna. Hey, come on in. It's great to see you.
Good to see you, too. I'm sorry I missed the lecture earlier. I wanted to...
It's okay.
So bad.
Do you like to sit on the couch there, or wherever you're comfortable?
Oh, the floor, always.
I'm telling the equivalent, I guess these are like Hare Krishna Reader's Digest stories about how I joined the movement and all these fun things. I was a student at Berkeley when I first joined the movement. And I wrote a letter to Prabhupada. He said to stay in college, and that I was much too, like, immature. I was 20 years old, so after having, you know, insisted my physics professor that the definition of energy is the potency of Krishna. So then I went to a French class. And in those days, there were no rules about sex harassment and all that, no laws. And so the French teacher was like, he couldn't have fit better the stereotype of the sort of Parisian guy. And literally, like to illustrate French grammar, he would call up, like, what he thought were the prettiest girls in the class, and he would, like, literally dance around the room with them.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it was like, meanwhile, here I am, this brahmachari, this, you know, new Hare Krishna, and I, hey, Bob.
Hare Krishna. I've got friends.
Oh, go on in.
The sharp woman, remember?
Sharp, she's a sharpie.
Yeah, she's a sharpie.
I was telling you how when I first joined the movement, how I, how immature it was. The stories were at my own expense. So I went to the French class. The French teacher was, like, doing all this stuff. And so here I am. I've been a devotee for about 3 days, but, like, you know, I'm morally outraged that he's doing all the things I used to do. So then the French teacher said, okay, I want to, because this is advanced French, I want to know how well you know French. I want everyone to write a little 5-minute talk and then, you know, in French. So who wants to go first, like the first day? You know, of course, no one volunteers, but I raised my hand because I thought I have to stop this iniquity. So, in my defense, I was only 20 years old and my brain was not fully formed.
You still had your fun now.
That was 10 years ago?
10 years ago. Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to be honest about this. So, I went home and I was looking up in the French dictionary, all these words like, people are like animals, like I find like the heaviest statements from these books. And then I went back to the class and I gave this, I just sort of pummeled the materialism of my professor, but he liked the talk. He said, that was really good, I really liked that. Of course, you know, it was disappointing because I wanted him to be wounded. Anyway, so my physics class, my French class, and I would go there with my shaved head or Krishna in my robes, and I would sit in my Elizabeth Berkeley, I'd just sit, you know, sit in the class, and I'd make a little altar of my desk, you know, with a little picture of Prabhupada. I mean, obviously, I wasn't even close to having the maturity of...
Well, that comes with time.
It does. I couldn't do these both these things of... you know, just being like a sane student, and also dealing with this overwhelming experience I just had of finding out that Krishna's real, and I mean, it really was. It was like the most dramatic possible experience that I got, like the free introductory offer. It's like, you know, join now and get like 20,000 bonus miles or something. And so, when I joined the Hare Krishna one, I just got these overwhelming experiences of Krishna, Prabhupada. So I dropped out. I dropped out of school, even though Prabhupada told me to finish my education. I couldn't really. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
God, there's a gazebo behind third base.
I have a question.
Yes.
So what was your religious? Did you have a religious upbringing? You might have already mentioned that, but before.
I was born in a Jewish family.
Okay.
That's cool.
But then later, I mean the order of this of a true spiritual master, a guru, was so powerful that I was kind of, I don't want to say haunted, but sort of like haunted in the sense of Casper the Friendly Ghost. But it just, I would have dreams about it, and just the order of Prabhupada. The Prabhupada directly told me that you should finish your education. And I can never forget, then in 1980, this is like after I'd been moving 11 years, I was, anyway, there were some administrative difficulties in Berkeley, so for several months I became the ad hoc person in charge of Berkeley. And so I was supposed to be managing the temple and all that, but really I could just go out every day and walk on the campus and dream about getting back into my studies. So, hey, Jai Keshava.
What's up, brother?
We need to close the door because apparently there's mosquitoes now. Someone else there?
Yeah.
Oh.
Halfway.
Is that rude? Is someone there? Hey, come on in.
Oh, there we go.
Thank you. Oh. Hey. Somebody get a
chance.
Hare Krishna.
One for the long ride.
Thanks for coming.
Let's see.
Yeah, don't put it too close to the door because...
You can come look at this. Isn't this awesome?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Perfect.
There you
go. Well,
if
you want 10 more, I'll
get
some more people.
Get in your way.
Offer them free food and...
Eat and switch.
Okay. Sorry to interrupt.
No, it's a pleasure to have you here. Hey! Oh, you back there. Yeah, maybe you. I can't. Lost eye contact there with...
Yeah. That's what I'm...
I remember when I used to, when I was in Cambridge, doing a graduate work, and I used to, we have a temple in Boston, and if you know Boston, it's in Back Bay. And so when I would come back to Cambridge, the temple there, this bridge that goes into Harbor Square, they have an old plaque on the bridge that says, the community of the wise is the welfare of the world. Mm-hmm. I thought that was really nice. So here we have a community of the wise.
Trying.
So as far as school, actually when I eventually got to Harvard, I was directly in Vedic studies, so to speak. And my main professor was a nice guy, we were friends and all that, but he was sort of world-renowned Vedicist, like sort of the older Sanskrit, but he would kind of put down the Vedic culture all the time, you know, like in all kinds of ways, and I sort of had to sit there and listen to all this. And So I felt that I'm here for Krishna. I'm here for Krishna. And ultimately, even by hearing people, let's say, espouse materialism, like crass materialism, I'm being empowered because I'm learning what the world is, what we have to do to spiritualize the world. So I felt that even the unpleasant things that I had to go through were empowering to me. And linguistics, actually, of course, you're in computational linguistics. So if you use everything for Krishna, there is a field which, of course, you're not in, which is historical linguistics. And that gets into all types of issues, like the antiquity of Sanskrit, and then the relation of Sanskrit to other ancient languages, and so on and so forth. But, I mean, we do have so many texts. Our tradition is extremely literate. If you look at, say, Lord Chaitanya, who was a great scholar, who was famous as a great scholar, and then his direct disciples.
I'm sorry.
No, we don't want you to lose it.
Is it there? Oh, okay.
Is that it?
That's it. I'm sorry.
It's okay, I had my eyes
on it. I forget things. I thought I left it out there. Thank you.
So, if you look at the direct disciples of Lord Chaitanya, the six Goswamis, they were great scholars. I mean, and if you look at the Bhagavatam, which is our main text, it's there was a famous Sanskritist named H.H. Ingalls, who, I don't know if he may have passed away, but back in the 20th century, for many years, he was sort of the dean of Sanskrit scholars in America, and he was the head of the Harvard Sanskrit Department. Very well known scholar, and he said that of all the literature he'd read, and of course he read in so many different languages, but of all the literature, great literature he read, world literature, he thought the most impressive work was the Bhagavatam. It's not just that God is for intellectuals, that's not the point at all. I mean, in fact, devotion, whether it's the devotion of a Jesus or a Krishna or Chaitanya, devotion to God has always been the great equalizer, the great sort of, you know, the social revolutionary force. Because you get these, in the material world, you get these hierarchies based on power and money and so on and so forth. And then the basic message of the great devotional movements has always been that really the greatest person is the one who loves the most. Like that great song by Curtis Mayfield in The Impressions. The one who loves the most. I mean, people get ready. So, anyway. And that's what Jesus did, and that's what Krishna did, and certainly Lord Chaitanya, is that you say, well, society has certain values, those values are materialistic, and obviously in any society, those who embody or control to the greatest extent that which the society positively values become the celebrities or the power brokers or the controllers of the culture. And our culture is actually very advanced today because we understand that great people do things like kicking inflated pigskin and you know, screaming into a microphone and ripping your clothes off, things like that. Things that really, profoundly benefit human society. So the idea is that, again, all these figures, whether it's a Jesus or Krishna or all these great figures, say that no, what's really important is the soul. What's really important is God. And so those are the real leaders of society, those who can teach everyone how to love God. And then, of course, religions, like economies, go through boom-bust cycles. Yeah, if you study the history of religion, you find this. So here's a typical boom-bust cycle. That you get a spiritual movement, the people are very sincere, very devoted, and really reaching out to other people. And so gradually society recognizes these people for their sincerity, their devotion, their purity. And because society wants to, people want to express their gratitude, their appreciation, they bestow gifts on these people. They build them monasteries or temples or this or that. And you see this in the life of St. Francis, who actually died prematurely because he's asleep you know, out on the bare earth when it was freezing and raining, and he basically just wore his body out. But even within his own life, within his own lifetime, St. Francis was kind of, in a very gentle, polite way, removed from the Franciscan order because, I mean, at least from the leadership, because he attracted these people, but the first generation of Franciscan monks thought, could we have a roof over our head? Because it may sound sweet and all that, so, but when you're actually sleeping out in the rain or it's freezing in the wind, it gets old. And St. Francis thought, well, come on, let's just, you know, go on that to it. So, but you can see that. So society, they bestow gifts, and what can happen over time, something we have to be aware of, what can happen over time is you have churches or temples or monastic orders that acquire all kinds of riches. For example, in India, they discovered this temple in South India. I forgot exactly where, but it's down in South India. And they found that temple, because it had been very prominent many, many years ago, long centuries ago, and had a treasury which they kept to finance the worship and everything. But they found this treasury buried beneath this temple, which today is worth many billions of dollars.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Padmanabha Swami Temple.
What's that?
Padmanabha Swami Temple.
Yeah, so... So what happens is that people can become corrupted because, I mean, think of it. If a spiritual movement really becomes successful and starts to influence and inspire large numbers of people, that's power. Mm-hmm. That's power. Because if people really have faith in their priests, their gurus, their teachers, or whatever, the teacher says, well, actually, this person is not a good political leader, that person's a good political leader. And so you can have huge voting blocks. You have... spiritual traditions or religious traditions becoming integral parts of local economies, and so you can see that, you know, you can see what could happen, and throughout history this can and has happened. Yeah. Not always. I mean, I wouldn't say it's necessary. It always happens, but it happens a lot. And then what happens is people realize, oh my God, our religious leaders, our priests, they're corrupted, and they're doing bad things, and so people. And so then a reformer comes along and says, actually, we've got to go back to basics and recover our original purity. And so that happens, and then it's a boom cycle again. So it's something we have to... It's something we have to pay attention to.
Swamiji, I have a question. Hopefully related. So,
sure.
I think has more to do with we're all lovers of Krishna, obviously. So that's a given. And I think the work I do, I'm a chaplain also, but also I see myself as someone who tries to like help people. Maybe be a normalizer to spirituality. In other words, help people understand that spirituality is also an adventure. It's fun. Creative. So when I say normalizer, I've had an interesting ride this year because as I've been coming to this temple and associating with all of these lovely people and making friends, and sharing that with other friends. Well, some of my friends say, are you nuts? Do you realize who you're hanging out with? And blah, 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 blah. And so I get a lot of, the task I see myself as being sort of the interface person between, come and see for yourself without, making this kind of rash judgment based upon some stereotype. That's been presented through media or through their past experience. Because as I've seen this organization, because I was, I grew up in LA, so I had a lot of interaction with different organizations. And so this organization is changing. It's almost becoming more accessible to people, more than it was before.
Oh, yeah.
Because it seemed before, and this is where I get this is my position in the interface. They say, they call me, I'm crazy, that you're crazy, pretty soon you'll be bald headed and wearing these strange clothes. So I said, well, so far here I am, and no one's told me to shave my head, no one's told me to wear unusual clothes, and I may still don them without, you know, being forced to, but nonetheless, that's my issue. But I think it's how do you see this organization evolving and changing as we go out and really present this teaching to the world? Because really, that's awesome. When you fall in love with Krishna, you help others fall in love with Krishna.
Right. Right.
So, and you have to kind of do it in a way that is not so. How can I say?
Repellent.
Well, repellent, or overly exotic. Or overly India-fied?
Are you preaching to the choir? Actually, okay.
This was Maharaj's position. Like, when did we last see
him? I mean, within the world of Hare Krishna movement, I'm sort of notorious as the one that's promoting all these ideas, just exactly as you put it. Mm-hmm. And, okay, I'll give you a... soul brother. Okay, I'll tell you.
From another mother.
I'll tell you how I see all this. First of all, we really appreciate you're here. I mean, everyone, Sandami, everyone I talked to is really appreciative that you're here with us. I was just in Palm Springs when I came here because I just didn't want to take long drives. I'm already tired enough. So stopped in Palm Springs for a few days, and I just at the natural food store where I went, you know, searching for human food. I got in a conversation with a lady there who ended up coming out to see us, and then she invited me home on the way here. And very nice lady. She lives in a big, beautiful house and was just diagnosed with cancer. You know, had kind of all her sort of material duckies lined up, and said, just suddenly started searching. I mean, the way she responded to this diagnosis was that my life now is all about finding God and finding the truth of my soul, and it was really, really impressive. And she confessed to me that when I was a girl, when I was growing up, you know, my mother told me Hare Krishnas were bad, and that was the end of it. And so, I'll tell you my take. First of all, I absolutely agree with you. And in fact, I want to start, as I put it, a movement within the movement called Krishna West. Hey, come on in. Hey, we're all waiting for you. Here's how I see it. When a spiritual tradition or religious tradition migrates, do you have something to sit on there? Okay. Yeah. When it migrates, when it goes from its country of origin to another land, whether it's Buddhism going east and north to Tibet and south to Sri Lanka, you know, east to China and Japan, so, or Christianity spreading in many ways, you know, Islam spread, or especially, I'd say, when a religion spreads in a non-military fashion. So Krishna consciousness coming to the West, coming to America. Actually, I have to throw this in. One of the early enthusiasts that really was, when Prabhupada was just had a few people with him in New York and just sort of getting things started, one of the people that really was gung-ho was Allen Ginsberg. And so there are many, many conversations. Allen Ginsberg used to do programs with Prabhupada at different universities. They would chant and Prabhupada would speak. But, and he said to Prabhupada, your presentation is too orthodox for the West. There are so many rules. And Prabhupada just laughed and said, if you knew how many rules I didn't bring, you would faint. And so Prabhupada was conscientiously trying to simplify it. And yet, when a spiritual tradition, let's say, comes to another culture, to another land or another culture, it doesn't just come as pure theology or even like just pure practice. It inevitably will come in a, you could say, an ethnic vehicle. So that, for example, in the Hare Krishna movement, just to be very honest, And Tucson, of course, is kind of refreshing, refreshingly open. And I mean, Tucson is really a bright spot for us. But I mean, the tendency is that to consider, let's say, Indian cuisine as somehow not by itself sacred, but most appropriate for sacred purposes. You know, assuming that, let's say, food has to be offered to Krishna to be sacred, but somehow Indian cooking, because so many great saints cooked in this way or whatever, that this is, or dress. I mean, of course, I'm wearing my dress. But the idea that somehow or other, let's say the practice of bhakti yoga is more powerful if you're wearing Indian dress, or that a temple is more appropriate, or somehow more a temple if the architecture is Indian, and so on and so forth. And so, personally, I don't believe that's true. And so I can humbly describe myself as a champion. But I've been really
pioneer.
Yeah. Pioneer. And so I mean I get letters all the time from all around the world from people that are really grateful that I'm kind of taking a stand on this. And then of course some people think I'm the anti-Krishna.
I heard about you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If Hare Krishna were in that post offices, you know, my picture would be in some of them. But I've been, because I'm one of the senior leaders, it's kind of that's what bothers some people. But in any case, this is how I see it. When people, let's say, when people adopt or embrace a spiritual tradition, and they embrace it, let's say, in a full-time or serious way, where there, it's not just like, okay, maybe occasionally I'll visit this, or I like this, or I'll... But they really take on a spiritual practice. This becomes my life. This becomes my primary self-understanding that I'm a servant of Krishna, for example. And then a person is, of course, has their memories. And these memories can really sort of, you know, they're like pulling you away. It's like, in the Odyssey by Homer, where Odysseus is driving, you know, is sailing by the sirens who sing these beautiful songs and lure sailors onto the rocks. And I remember literally, like the first week I joined a Hare Krishna temple, and we would go out on the street at Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley, you know, like these little saffron ducklings. all the Ramacharis we would line up, and we would just chant down Telegraph Avenue. I remember, because I'd been a student there for 3 years in Berkeley, and literally everywhere I looked just reminded me of some iniquity. And so, because I'd been, you know, just a normal Berkeley hedonist. And so I remember, and my consciousness had been so elevated by adopting Krishna consciousness. I mean, really, I had this dramatic transformation of consciousness. So really, Krishna really did lift me from the material platform to the spiritual platform. It was just like, it was just, could not be more startling and overwhelming, like this transformation of consciousness. And so, and yet certain things, of course, would threaten this new enlightenment, like, you know, looking at places where I used to engage in non-spiritual activities. And so I remember that as I was walking down the street, it was with my new, like, it's almost like the army, they give you your boots and your uniforms. So I got my saffron sweatshirt, my saffron shirt, my saffron dhoti, my saffron turban. We used to wear turbans then. This is 1969. And as I took my place as, you know, one of the saffron ducklings, we were just like chanting down the street. And I remember the only safe place for my eyes, like trying to keep my consciousness up there, the only safe place for my eyes was the sweatshirt in front of me. And I remember that. I just had to train my eyes on the saffron sweatshirt of the devotee in front of me. So if I looked anywhere else, my consciousness would just go, phew, because I... So the world, in that sense, I mean, it really does kind of threaten your consciousness. It's, you know, it can pull you away like the siren song. And so I think a lot of devotees, I mean, of course, you get to a certain point. Like in my own life, you get to a certain point where it's like nothing bothers you. because you're just sort of, you're stronger and you're more comfortable in your spiritual life. So it's like whatever. But I think some devotees, perhaps because they had unpleasant, like before they became, took up bhakti yoga, maybe they suffered in some way, or maybe they had certain, I don't want to say addictions, but, you know, really involved in some. So in some way, they find it liberating to sort of take on a dress and take on a culture which is completely different and where nothing reminds them of their past. And I think, you know, psychologically something like that is happening. And so I find that some people, and I don't want to criticize them or belittle them or say like somehow that's, but I think that's what's going on. And of course the fact is, a lot of these like Vedic things like dress and architecture really have histories, they're not that old anyway. Like what many devotees, let's say, would call Vedic architecture, which is sort of Indian architecture, has, of course, Mughal influences and even European influences and so on and so forth. Or the cuisine, for example, like when you're cooking for the deities, you know, you should cook certain preparations because that's what Krishna likes, because that's what the tradition has already, always offered. But it's I mean, it can be kind of amusing because like one of the most typical, let's say, what they call in India sabjis or vegetable preparations would be, let's say, something with potatoes, tomatoes, peas, or chili or something. And if you say like potatoes, tomatoes, and chilies, none of them even existed until the Europeans came, because they come from the Western Hemisphere. And yet somehow or other, it's, I mean, I think any religious movement, especially when it's young, but this, to the credit of ISKCON, it really is genuine, the devotees really are sincere, and it really is maturing, so we're really getting there. But in the meantime, I mean, it definitely has this Monty Python element. And,
the next month.
Oh, yeah. I mean, God. I'm amazed they missed us. Selection of theme. And to some extent, the early days of the movement, we were like going out, you know, and selling things to people. I mean, I describe it sometimes as it was like Vedic Lord of the Flies. Because you had all these young people, and there were no elders. Even if you study like gorilla families and elephants, like any sort of like more, if they're deprived of their elders, they find that the communities, say elephants, gorillas, humans, if they're deprived of their elders, they engage in irrational behavior, even self-destructive, antisocial behavior. And so when you get a bunch of young, zealous people coming right off the, you know, right out of the Vietnam manifestation, civil rights, and off the pigs and tear down the system and all that. And so they go, okay, this is the absolute truth and everyone out there is an illusion and they're, you know, they're killing animals and they're doing this and that. It's so... So you get this, you know, almost like, I don't know, you call it Tarzanic Hare Krishna movement. You know, back in the early 70s.
Well, you made it into the musical Hair, so that was pretty good.
Yeah, oh my God. Let me tell you what we used to do for the musical Here. Okay. Then, by the way, that's the first time I heard Hare Krishna. I had a really good friend in high school, Roberta, who lived right across the street from the high school. And I did a lot of sports. And so almost every day, for a year or two, every day after school, I just walked right across the street to her house and eat her family out of house and home. And her parents were really nice, and they would always feed me. So she had the Hair album. She had the Hair album. That's the first time I heard Hare Krishna. So then I joined the movement because Hair was like really big, and so I joined in Berkeley. We used to go to Sankirtan in San Francisco where Hair was playing. And then later Prabhupada sent me to Boston and was playing there also. And so what we would do is to collect funds, because we were just a bunch of young people. We all dropped out, like, how are we going to pay the rent? How are we going to keep the movement going? So we would go to the Hair concert at night. It was late at night, so we'd get out around midnight, 11:30 or midnight when the show would end. And we, you know, we were all dressed in our saffron vest. A little Hare Krishna tuxedos. And then, and so we would stand there. I mean, we didn't offer PTSD back then, like therapy. But anyway, so then we'd hear the doors buckle, the theater, big theater doors, you know, the handle would buckle. We knew people were coming out. We had like this 10-minute window Because like hundreds and hundreds of people, you know, who had money because they were going to the theater, hundreds of people would come out, they just heard Hare Krishna, and we had to sell them incense. And we had only 10 minutes. And so, you know, I was just, you know, just a peon back then. So they'd give us like a handful of incense like that. Right? And we have to light it. And really, it would go, it's flame. And sometimes actually it's hard to put it out. It's like, you know, we're definitely. And you know, the people were coming, and I did this every night for months in San Francisco. I mean, I did this so many times, and then so when we finally got the incense out, and there'd be so much smoke, and literally like we were blinded by the incense smoke, and our eyes were tearing, and we just see like these shadowy forms coming towards us. They were all these people coming out of the theater. And we had 10 minutes, and like, Hare Krishna, yeah, yeah. Hare Krishna, they just seen Hare Krishna, you know, give a donation. And I mean, there was so much incense smoke, I could hardly see the people. It was just like, and then we had these brass begging bowls. And we were very sincere. I mean, we weren't, yeah. No one, not one of us would take one penny for any selfish purpose.
So did you make a lot of money that way, though?
We'd make about... we probably make about maybe $100 in 10 minutes. But and I was the treasurer. But as I said, there wasn't a single one of us.
Yeah.
I was actually the treasurer. There wasn't a single one of us who would take a penny. No one ever imagined taking a penny for any selfish purpose. Everything was just for putting on programs for the public. But we didn't know what else to do. Because you're Hare Krishna, you know, what else are you going to do? How are we going to make money? And I remember in Boston, oh my God, the Prabhupada sent me to Boston. I did the same thing at the hair show in Boston. And it was so passionate. We were all so young. It was just, you know, we were all just young kids. And so when the doors opened there, they would chant Hare Krishna and play it so fast. Because, like, you know, and I remember that no one could play the drum more than about 2 or 3 minutes because they get worn out. They're playing so fast. And so the drum would just go down the line down the chorus line of devotees. So anyway, I mean, we were young, though. We were just young kids. We didn't know anything. We had no elders. I mean, there were no elders in the Hare Krishna movement because Prabhupada had tried to attract, you know, mature, intelligent people, but no one, you know, as he finally said, kind of gave up, said, old dogs can't learn new tricks. So he just sort of gave up. And that's, you know, we were kind of like Plan B because Prabhupada came. Prabhupada was born in the 19th century. He was born in 1896, and he was born under an emperor. Wow. Prabhupada wasn't born in a democracy. He was born within an empire. And so he had all these views. And so Prabhupada's conception at first, you can see this very clearly in the biography, was that you approach the leaders of society. If you can convince, so to speak, the aristocrats or the leaders of society, then, you know, the people will take it. Because that's the world he grew up in. And so he wrote letters, he appealed to world leaders that, you know, please accept Krishna consciousness. This is a humble presentation to say that, you know, we're trying to spiritualize the world. It's desperately needed. Please help this movement. It's not sectarian. This is not a fanatical religion. It's for everyone. And he wrote these, like, really heartrending letters. And of course, Prabhupada got no replies. So finally, in India, before he came to America, he was addressing all kinds of leaders and poor people of the world, and of course no one wanted to help him. So finally, he was so determined that I have to follow the order of my guru, that he finally just got on a cargo ship. He was 68 and a half years old when he got on the boat, almost 69. He had heart attacks on the way over. He had $7, you know, and rupees or something, but he just thought, I don't know if I'll survive the trip. I don't know what I'll do when I get there. Prabhupada once said to me, personally, I was with him in Los Angeles in his room, and he said that when I was getting off the boat, when he finally got to New York, he said, when I was getting off the boat, I had no idea whether I should turn right or left. He had no idea where he was, what he should do. He just knew that I have to carry out the order of my guru. And so then he came to New York. He first went to Butler, Pennsylvania, because he had a friend in India, an Indian gentleman, whose son had gone to America. In those days, there were very few Indians in America. And, you know, they would never appear in those days, like on The Simpsons. And so...
Yeah.
So, and that son of Prabhupada's friend in India lived in Butler, Pennsylvania, which is also very distinguished, I think, as being the original home of Rig Santorum. In any case, so Prabhupada went to Butler, Pennsylvania, stayed with this nice couple, an Indian man, he had an American wife, and he sort of sat there and he thought, well, okay, how do I save the world out of Butler? So he went and gave a little talk at the YMCA in Butler, Pennsylvania. As we know, as goes the Butler YMCA, so goes the YWCA. So anyway, he gave his talk, and then
he
did.
Like, will it play in Peoria?
Yeah. So then he asked him, I made a contact with this PhD student at Penn, the Ivy School, the University of Pennsylvania, Thomas Hopkins, who became a very prominent Indologist. And so he made a little academic. And finally he realized that I don't think this world is going to start in Butler. So, with all due respect to Butler. So he, I think, got a bus to New York City. And he arrived in New York City, but had no money, just alone in New York City. And somehow or other, he found a loft. In those days, I mean, you could find very cheap places in those days. And he somehow got a loft, or he shared a loft with some crazy, crazy hippie. Literally, was crazy. Went on bad trips, and he almost attacked Prabhupada and threw his typewriter out of the second story window. So he was just like alone there in New York. And so, but Prabhupada, like ever the determined servant, he brought books with him. It's interesting, he once said to me, when I first took sannyas, the sannyas order of life, in 1972, I went to Prabhupada's room. Prabhupada was there in Los Angeles, and I went to his room. And our governing body, the GBC, had voted. They had a meeting at the same time. They voted that I should go to Spain and open up Spain, bring Krishna come. Because in those days we were sort of opening up the world. And so I went to see Prabhupada, and he said, "So, what are you going to do now? Like, I just gave you sannyas. Like, what are you going to do? You want to make sure you stay out of trouble?" And so I told him that I was Hare Krishna, come on in. I told him that the GBC asked me to go to Spain. And then Prabhupada said, don't go to Spain unless you have books in Spanish. Because he said, when I came to your country, he said, that was my confidence. He said, I brought my books, the Bhagavatam he printed in India. And that's what he said. When I got off the boat, I didn't know whether I should turn right or left. But I wasn't afraid. My confidence was that I had my books. And so Prabhupada actually went around New York City selling his books in bookstores here and there. And he somehow eked out a little, just barely, a survival there, just by doing that. And then things started to happen. People, because he was walking around in his robes, and people approached him and took interest in what he was doing, and they started little programs. He didn't have an Indian drum, so he went to Tompkins Square Park in Manhattan, and someone gave him a bongo drum. And he would just sit under a tree in the park in New York City in Manhattan, just sit under a tree and play his bongo drums and chant Hare Krishna. And people started becoming attracted. He started giving classes, and a community formed around him. So, and of course, then Allen Ginsberg came. He became really enthusiastic, wanted to help Prabhupada. They would do programs together, and then Prabhupada made a record. Somehow they, because that, that was the '60s, late '60s, and things were kind of effervescing, and. So they met one guy who had this little independent record company. That's when they actually had vinyl records. And so they made a record of Prabhupada chanting Hare Krishna. And then somehow or other, who should buy one of those records but it was George Harrison. And the next thing you know, the Beatles, who were at the peak of their fame and need a break because they're kind of getting burned out, so they decide, the four of them, they're going to take a vacation and just sail throughout the Greek islands. And so they go sailing in the Greek islands just to get away from it all. No, 68. And they take a little battery record player. And the one record they bring is Prabhupada's record. And so especially John Lennon and George Harrison just literally all day, day after day, just chant Hare Krishna. And then eventually Prabhupada sent people, some of his disciples, to London, and they meet the Beatles, and then, anyway, so all kinds of things start to happen. So, and then, George, they want to build a new altar, they're fixing up the temple for London, and George says, oh, I've got a friend who'll give a donation for the altar. So that's who gave for the first altar was Mick Jagger.
Oh, wow.
And so then Prabhupada sent some disciples to open up a temple in San Francisco, and they go to the Haight-Ashbury, of course. And then they're right up, there's a band that lives right across the street from the temple. And so the band likes the Hare Krishna. So they say, okay, well, because you're feeding the community, so we'll buy you a stove, you know, big stove, so you can feed the community. So that band, of course, is the Grateful Dead. And so it's really interesting. And then these other bands in San Francisco say, well, we'll put on a charity concert, you know, to help the movement get started. So Jefferson Airplane, you know, mm-hmm. Janis Joplin, Big Brother and the Holding Company, and all these bands come and hold a charity concert for Prabhupada. Wow. So he can, you know, get his movement going. Wow. And they all chant with Prabhupada. So, I mean, it was interesting, but again, it was obviously Krishna's plan, but it was, from Prabhupada's point of view, plan B. Because, I mean, plan A was, because again, Prabhupada was born in an empire. He was born in the 19th century, and you approach the leaders, the aristocracy, and they accepted, everyone accepted, but of course, the world's not like that now. And so, so we were all just young. We were just young. Just a bunch of young people, and coming right out of the political movements. I mean, I was on the streets of Berkeley just trying to avoid the tear gas. And and the next thing you know, it's like, we just have to redirect that passion. Okay, it's not that, it's this. So that, I mean, that was the Hare Krishna movement. And then we started selling Prabhupada's books, and it really became like sociologically almost like, it became very militant, because we were organized, you know, to save the world, because we were just young. And what happened is that whole era just ended, you know, the 60s and early 70s, the world changed. Vietnam War ended, and just everything changed, and we began to grow up. And we just got older, and it actually, and this is like shocking, but it actually started to become an adult movement. You know, the Hare Krishna movement. And so, then I was kind of like the, I don't know what to say, like the Jackie Robinson of ISKCON Academics. I mean, I was actually the one, because we had this, I mean, it's typical. If you study early Buddhism, to give you an example, just sociologically, how early powerful spiritual movements are. There was another spiritual movement, a religious movement that started, and they published in their main text, actually, that, well, first of all, they had a rule. They had a rule that if you join the community, it's communal, you got to give everything, you can't keep any private property. They had that rule. You have to give all your possessions. And so this couple joined, a husband and wife, and you know, did you give everything? Yeah, we gave all the property. But because they were married, I guess they had plans for the future. In a family, they actually kept some land in their name. And then the man died and the woman died kind of like prematurely under strange circumstances. And this new religion, this new movement declared that God killed them because they didn't give all their property. And this story, of course, is in the New Testament. The Jesus movement. This is in the book of Acts. And so, the point I'm trying to make is not a criticism of the Jesus movement, but just saying that there's a certain sociology of, for example, in early Buddhism, there was a huge controversy, first of all, whether women could join, and, of course, they eventually decided women could join, whether you could be a Buddhist if you're not a celibate monk. That was a big issue. Can you be, like, can a married person be a Buddhist? Can a woman be a Buddhist? And so, if you look at the first generation of these, you know, very zealous, very for powerful spiritual movements are like that. And so, but as time passes, kind of, what did, I saw a bumper sticker that said, nature bats last, like in baseball. And so we just sort of grew up. So now these same guys and girls are sort of running around, you know basically, you know, playing hide and seek, you know, trying to escape from mall cops. And, you know, just sell things. And I mean, literally, like, all kinds of zany things, like jumping over barriers. And I mean, literally, it's like cops and robbers, because we had to sell these books, we got to save the world. And now, these same people are grandparents. And, you know, they've had to, I mean, you learn a lot. So again, And there is. I mean, one really good thing about the Hare Krishna movement that I like a lot is it really is, in many ways, an open, free society. I mean, clearly, any society, in order to be defined as such, has to have certain boundaries. In fact, like Sociology 1A, the definition of the society is a group of people that share a common highest authority in some way. I mean, otherwise, it's not a society. So, but in ISKCON, I remember one time when I was in Finland, in Helsinki, I was speaking to a scholar who was sort of like the main scholar in Finland to study new religious movements. And he studied all these, and he said that ISKCON, compared to many other religious movements, he found the difference was that ISKCON was so open. And sort of like, you know, you could sort of say what you thought, and there wasn't heavy central control, and so on. I mean, sometimes it's you know, it seems like, you know, anarchy is more of a threat than you know, centralization. But still, ISKCON really is it's a constitutional movement. It's not like there's some big leaders and they kind of tell everybody what to do. It's not like that. In fact, it's really the rule of law. It's a constitutional movement. And for example, I have very strongly advocated, you know, very controversial things like you don't have to be ethnically Indian to practice bhakti yoga. I mean, you can actually, you know, and things like that. So, and I've advocated things which are very controversial, but you kind of know where the boundaries are. You kind of, you know, like how far you can push. But I have pushed very hard, and there are all kinds of debates. There are all kinds of debates within ISKCON, like really knockdown, drag out debates about how we should do this, how we should do that, and it's permissible. I mean, people, there are times when, let's say, there have been grassroots movements within ISKCON where, let's say, the governing body was sort of hesitating about something, but there was grassroots support for something, and the governing body recognized, and sort of, so to speak, the will of the people, then, you know, enacted certain things, and so. In fact, if you look at ancient Vedic culture, let's say if you read Mahabharata, if you read it as a political scientist or a social scientist, if you read the Mahabharata, what you find is an amazingly open and free society. Even many, many thousands of years ago, it was constitutional monarchy. It was not absolute monarchy. It's a very key distinction in political science between, let's say, absolute monarchy, like that's sort of like the off with their heads from Alice in Wonderland.
Henry VIII.
Yeah, exactly. Henry VIII, just sort of like a tyrant that can just do anything and is above the law. And as opposed to constitutionalism, where the monarch is not above the law, that the monarch also has to follow the laws, which is a different form of government. So, for example, the Mahabharata, the great historical epic of ancient India, when the people thought that the king, Dhritarashtra, and his son, Duryodhana, the prince, had assassinated the Pandavas by burning down their house, the House of Lack. The Pandavas actually escaped, but no one knew it. And so the world thought they'd been killed. And the people were so outraged because they knew, you know, the king has done this. They couldn't prove it, they knew it. And so the text describes the people just went out into the center of the city, the imperial capital, and just began, you know, insulting the king, that, you know, he's done this, he's done that. And there's never the slightest hint of reprisals or that you couldn't do that. I mean, typically, again and again, in these ancient texts, Bhagavatam, Mahabharata, when people criticize the government, criticize the king, the typical response is, how can we win back the people's favor? I mean, there's hardly a single incident I can think of in these texts. These are very big books, where someone is persecuted or, you know, really severely punished because they criticize the leader. So there's actually freedom of speech in ancient India. And there's freedom of religion. For example, an example of freedom of religion, the Vedic culture was the religion of South Asia. And then you got these new movements like, for example, Buddhism or Jainism. And in the beginning, especially, there's a whole history of Buddhism and how it transformed and eventually kind of, you know, never really escaped the gravitational field of Hinduism. That's a whole history. But But in the beginning, when they were very much like, you know, against the Vedic stuff, the Vedic sacrifices, and that was their whole, that was their preaching platform, that, you know, that we reject all this stuff, we reject the Vedic social hierarchy, the Varna system, and we reject the sacrifices, they just like reject everything. What's interesting is, they didn't fight over it, there were no wars over this. I mean, if you went into medieval Europe and started preaching against Christianity, I mean, they just couldn't cut your head off fast enough, or slow enough, actually, that you made you suffer more. And so, there was a cultural battle. I mean, at one time, I mean, even within the Vedic culture, there were Vaishnavas, there were Shaivas, there were Shaktas, who worship the goddess, there were Tantrikas, the Tantra stuff, there were Buddhists, there were Jains, there were other groups that we don't even know about now. And they were all fighting to win the hearts and minds of the people. And it was an open society. And eventually, actually, I mean, I gave a whole course on this in university, but I mean, eventually, the big winner in this level playing field, to quote George W. Bush, you know, on this level playing field, and where everyone had a fair shot to try to persuade people, the big winner by far, that just really became the dominant spiritual culture of that civilization was Krishna consciousness. So, for example, the Bhagavad Gita, spoken by Krishna, became the book of South and even parts of Southeast Asia. It became the book, Bhagavad Gita, spoken by Krishna. The Mahabharata became the great epic narrative, and the Ramayana, the story of Ram, another avatar of Vishnu, Krishna. And, according to scholars, the first great megalithic temples, which were in South India, were Vaishnava temples for, you know, for Krishna and Vishnu, and so on. So, I mean, there's no equivalent. If you look at what is now called Hinduism, which is a modern term actually, in the last few hundred years, but if you look at Hinduism, there's no equivalent to the avatars of Vishnu, the famous avatars, which are just like just at the heart of an Indian civilization, There's no Bhagavad Gita. There's no book that has anywhere near the influence of a Gita, of a Bhagavatam, and so on, of a Ramayana. It's just the heart of that civilization. So again, Krishna consciousness emerged as the dominant, by far the dominant spiritual culture. Within a very extremely diverse, sophisticated, free civilization. And now, as I sometimes say, I see Prabhupada coming as really the completion of the Renaissance project. Because if you consider what the Renaissance is, you know, the rebirth, you know what that means, rebirth. It's a rebirth of what? To rebirth of Indo-European civilization. Get some oxygen. If you look at, like for example, ancient Greek, if you study ancient Greek, which I'm sure you're all going to run home and do. Yeah. But if you study ancient Greek, it's like startling how close it is to Sanskrit. It's not only like historically related to Sanskrit, but it's startling how close it is to Sanskrit. I mean, I go into all kinds of details you probably don't want to hear, but Greek and Latin, and so the classical civilization of Europe, the classical, you know, the pagan civilization, which achieved really like incredible heights in terms of architecture, literature, philosophy, theater, and so on. And then, of course, Europe by various factors was plunged into dark ages. And then when it started to come out of these dark ages, Europe came out of the dark ages by rediscovering their pagan past. It's a whole story. In fact, it was the early founders of the Renaissance, people like Petrarch and Dante and so on, in the 1300s, it was the early founders of the Renaissance who coined the term dark ages. It's not like, you know, we should...
On the calendar at the time.
Yeah. And they coined the term Middle Ages because why Middle Ages? Because it's in the middle between the glories of classical civilization and their revival. But what's interesting is, if you look at classical civilization, it's very obviously Indo-European culture. The way I describe it is, if you study Roman religion, you know, ancient Roman religion, it's simply Mediterranean Hinduism. It really is. I mean, we go on and on and on and on showing all the parallels. It's just Mediterranean Hinduism. And so now, Prabhupada coming to America, ironically, come on in.
The medicine down
here? Yeah. Oh.
Mary's looking for a plate. Sorry, you're right.
No problem. No corporal punishment tonight. We're all in good mood. So, I mean, getting back to your point about, you know, people think this is strange. The irony of it is that Western people are actually recovering their original culture. Because this is the original Indo-European civilization. That's something which actually, anyway, there's a whole history of the 19th century Indologists and how they came to this conclusion and so on. But yeah, so Krishna consciousness really means it's a completion of the Renaissance project, because a rebirth of classical civilization, a full rebirth of it, means a rebirth of Indo-European civilization. And so the fact that Western people would say, like, what's this weird thing you're bringing over here? And there's a real irony in that. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
So what time is it now?
9:00.
So it's the bewitching hour. So maybe we'll end here. Anyway, thank you all so much. It was great.
I've been called worse.
What's that?
I've been called worse. Many blessings. Thank you for entering us.
Charter of
Jay.
Yeah, thank you all for as Elvis used to say, you've been a great audience.
Thank you very much. Thank you.